Cherry Developer News, episode number 43 for Thursday, February 16th, 2012. I am Ken Rimple.
And Gordon Dickens.
And we are here to talk about technology and, you know, what's interesting to us. So, Gordon, it's been about, I guess, a week and a half since you joined back up with us for the last Dev News, and we're going to be doing some of these ourselves now, the training group. Quick note for anybody who is looking for a good consulting gig, Chariot is hiring. We're looking for open source, comfortable developers who do work in things like Spring, Ruby on Rails, anything along those lines, mobile. And so if you want to do the stuff we do, you want to be able to, you know, communicate all these open source projects and participate in these great things and do ETE every year and all that, please get in touch with us. You can hear us on the web at chariotsolutions.com/jobs, I believe is the URL for that. All right, so let's start off then. So this week we have a number of different things. A lot of them, there's a few releases, but a lot of them are things like nice little enhancements to APIs. And then we have, like, what I like to start up with is a couple of videos from O'Reilly Media. So Gord, why don't you take it with the mastering, well, let's just discuss it. They have a Mastering Grails 101 video that just came out with Tim Berglund and Matthew McCullough. And I mentioned it to you, and you immediately went, hold it. I was listening to or watching McCullough and Berglund on Mastering Advanced Git. So why don't we back up and talk about that one?
Sure. There's the fabulous duo of Berglund and McCullough have a series of videos out, apparently. And purchased the Advanced Git and then Mastering Advanced Git series. The Mastering Advanced Git just came out in January, and I'm still finishing up actually the first one, but it's a great introduction, a good like roundtable discussion and examples that these guys give on using Git. So looking forward to starting the Mastering Advanced Git, but that's, you know, they've got a good dialogue, and like I said, they do a roundtable discussion and talk with the students that are there, like just a set of, you know, gentlemen that are there that learning at the same time.
Oh, that's kind of cool.
So it's kind of nice. It's and they have, you know, they do the presentation is really well in the videos. They show the code. They'll split the screen. So if they're showing, you know, in the case of Git, like one person's checkout, the other person's, you know, view of that state of the repository, that you can see that split screen. They do a really good job of presentation there. So yeah, they just came out with a Mastering Grails video series. It's over 3 hours of you know, really an intro level, what is Groovy, and then what is Grails and the fundamental components of Grails, so you can get started with Grails very quickly. I'm not certain. Yeah, it looks like it's covering Grails 2.0.
Great.
And it looks like Grails 2.01 just came out. Isn't that one of the other?
Yeah, that's
links?
One of the. Yeah, it's coming up. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So yeah, I recommend it. I think you know, Matthew and Tim give a good. Have a good dynamic, and they present really, really useful information and try to give you different perspectives on things, so you grasp it. So they'll say it one way, and then someone will say it a different way, so that, you know, one of those sticks for you.
Right, and it's nice to see it as a video, because some people are very visual learners, and they like to see what's going on and get the, you know, interactive stuff. We're doing the same kind of thing for our, you know, experiments with screencasts too, and sure. And I think that is definitely in your different learning styles kind of thing important.
Yeah, and if you know, sometimes when I get some things like that and I know some of it, I'll put it on in the behind the screen, you know, and listen to it. And then if I hear something that catches my interest, like, oh, wait a minute, I didn't know about that option, I'll switch over, you know, slide back a little bit in the video, and then catch up to that point. So it's good stuff. I mean, I like the video series a lot. I just don't have time to read the books as much. And when they can summarize this stuff in a video series, it's nice. And you can just jump into the chapter you want.
Right. Cool. All right, let's talk about new releases. Both you and I care about this one a lot, Spring Roo. So as I'm getting the book ready to finalize, it's like changing everything to 1.2.0, because I'm thinking, you know, hey, 1.2.0 is coming out. So
good
I went
plan.
Through. Oh, yeah. This is back in December. I'm like, we're almost done with this sucker. So here I am searching, replacing all the repository entries, testing everything against Roo 1.2.0. And I get around to the point where we're handing it off. We hand it off to Manning. And I get this email.
Newsflash.
Yeah, newsflash from one of the developers. I think it was Andrew Swan saying, there's going to be an update. I'm like, no. By the way, that's been the bane of our existence for this book. It's every time there's a major update,
right,
the major chapter changes. But he made me happy, because it turns out that Roo 1.2.1 does not have a lot of changes to the technical features. In fact, I think it's all bug fixes. like apparently the number of issues with the multi-module Maven, which is something they just put out in 1.2.0.
Okay.
And I think people were complaining about, you know, creating projects a certain way. It wasn't honoring the dependencies and things like that in various places. So I know there are a number of JIRAs around that.
Yeah, I had put a JIRA ticket in to support that a while back. So, yeah. You know, it's...
That's 1.20.
I haven't tried it something in 1.2.0 yet, though. Yeah. I haven't tried the multi-Maven build.
It worked pretty well when I played with it. It even has the concept of, you know, how they have, like, focus on entities. So you'll, you create a JPA entity, and it says focus of that name in the shell. Well, now they have a focused project as well. So you can say project or module focus, and it's I think it's like entity vertical bar project.
Maybe a quick summary on that. Is it multi-project in terms of like smaller projects in a big project, or is it parent to child relationship?
So it's you can create a POM module for the top. And then you can create multiple modules below.
Okay.
I think you can also create a war module for the top. I'm not sure. I haven't tried that yet. Hmm. But doing a war and then, you know, having the modules below it support the war.
Okay.
But you can do a POM, do a war module, do a JAR module, have your web app in the war module, and have, you know, utilities, services repository, right. Stuff like that in the other. And that works really well.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
I have to play around with that then.
Yeah, it's nice. It's really like one of the biggest complaints that enterprise developers had. Like, you know, we use Maven everywhere. We want to modularize, bring in other things. And they will actually find Spring Beans because using ClassPath star for their search for the different Spring context files, and they find them from all of the JARs of the dependent objects. So it's really nice.
That's great.
Yes.
Yeah, I definitely have to start playing with that. I've been using Rue quite a bit to create, you know, create demo projects and such for the training classes, but I haven't really tried the multi-Maven build feature of it yet.
It's very cool. It's very cool. So that's one of the big issues. They also apparently, now I'm not a JSF fan, but they're supporting Prime Faces as one of their JSF widget libraries, I guess, which is kind of like, I think if I'm wrong about this, someone shoot me. I think that's the commercial version of Rich Faces, but Prime Faces 3.1. Is what they're supporting, and they revved it to Google App Engine 1.6.2. Again, something else I fell off the wagon on since Heroku has come out, and I've been experiencing with that and other things like CloudBees. So anyway, so you can find that information at springsource.com/spring-roo and download it. One little quirk I found, if you go to the download page for Roo and you say, no thanks, take me to the downloads, it shows this broken link.
Yeah, there was a broken link. I did see that.
Yeah, and it's still like that.
Yeah, okay. I jumped around and found it. Yeah. Somewhere else, or it refreshed.
Right. If you just hit refresh on that page, it will bring all the downloads down, and you can open up Spring Roo and download the release. So, yeah, they'll fix that at some point, maybe after this. Okay, cool. So that's news. Here's another interesting one. I'm just going to kind of jump down to Grails 2.0.1. So they have an update to Grails 2.0. 2.0 came out, I guess, a month ago, and 2.0.1 is a bug fix version for that. They apparently had 80 different defects that they worked on. I'm just going to flip the change log list and see if there's anything to note here. Let's see here. I mean, so much. There literally are a ton of things
in here.
There's
three improvements and one new feature
and 80 bugs. Which is nice. They fixed a ton of stuff. So, you know, single line creation syntax of domain class with one emitting mapping has stopped working in 2.0. I don't know. So some sort of creation of a domain in a one-liner was blowing up. Hmm. You know, a bunch of stuff. A lot of things that are regressions. But anyway, so if you're a Grails person and you didn't know there was a 2.0.1, take a look at it. That's a lot of bug fixes there. And the new improvements, actually, plugin info should display dependency string and required repositories. Command classes errors property should be a validation errors object as opposed to a bean property binding result, which makes it, I guess, more in line with the Spring MVC validation. And then for consistency reason, relative years and date picker should use reverse int ranges to display the years in reverse order. Okay, interesting. So those are very kind of minor, I think.
It must have been enough of a collective, though, that it motivated them to put the release out so soon. So,
which is great. I mean, it's only been a couple of weeks.
So that's a good thing, and it's probably a good upgrade or good update to get.
Yeah. Yep. So anyway, grails.org, go download the newest release. Be happy. All right. While we're going through our releases here, let's see. Spring 3. Well, it's old. Hold on. Developer News 43. By the way, if you're following along, it's delicious.com/developernews/43 is where we contribute them. We ultimately will then put them on our show notes page at techcast.chariotsolutions.com. All right. I think that's all the releases. So now we're just kind of getting into things we bookmarked that were interesting to us. First up on that would be taking your programming course with a grain of salt, please. Now, I like the Schneid blog, schneide.wordpress.com. And on the 13th, on Monday, the guy who wrote this put out a nice little blog post about they had an intern that was working with them, and now he's studying informatics at a university. He came back, and they were looking at some stuff. He was looking at his code for what he did at a programming course with them, getting their feedback. They were kind of talking about different ways of implementing a particular method. They were looking at like this complex single return code. You know, like sometimes you have like this really difficult return at the end of a method.
Right.
And then you're like, well, that's ugly. Let's refactor it. And maybe early on in the block, you return one thing, like an early return.
Right.
And, you know, so they were talking about that. And so why don't you try an early return? And it said, I am not allowed to do that. So apparently you're not allowed to write good code. He said, my instructor prefers the single return approach over the early return style. And he announced there will be a painful deduction of points if we don't comply to this style. So Gestapo programming?
Well, I think there's a merit to that. I play devil's advocate. There's a merit to that from the instructor perspective, because sometimes if they're a junior developer, you want to try to establish better practices in people. So you kind of do a little, you know, aggressive, direction management, or management of
guide
behaviors. So yeah, I can see that. But there's some comments at the bottom about the single entry, single exit theory, and that's a really good practice. I mean, it's easier to track that way. It's just it depends on your perspective in terms of the return style. If it's a very complicated return, I think there's a value to easier readable code. There's also there's performance reasons. There's the it depends methodology, right? It depends on the scenario, but there are practices that you kind of have to, you should stick with, even, and then just subtleties from there. So I don't see this as a bad style. And one of the techniques I use when I teach Spring is the first day and I'm usually dealing with developers who are already programmers.
Right.
So, but they're already Java programmers, and I want to tell them one thing: stop using the word new in Spring. Now, you can knee-jerk and say, wait, what? But think about it. There's a very small use case for that. And if I need to stop them from reverting to old habits, because they're going to get in a panic state when they're coding with a timeline.
And throw in a new,
and then they don't have a life cycle. And so there's a reason that those things are put in. You need to sometimes take away the old habits and instill new habits by giving them these hard rules. So
I think if I understand the article angle on this too, is that this guy who was going to school had some programming ability already, so he was trying to apply what he knew, and the teacher just slapped him down, and there were a bunch of these rules, and he was just saying, no, but really, I think this is good programming style, and he would have actually failed the class for writing reasonably decent code. So it's one of those things where I think it's that you're absolutely right. In the very beginning, you have to give them a box in which that they can start getting some success in learning, but they have to understand they're kind of in the early part of their journey on that process.
Right.
That these are just guideposts so that you can get a feel for what it's like to program in a language,
sure, or
to even what programming is. And then as you get more experience, you start opening up the kimono a little bit and opening up the curtain saying, this is good.
Right.
Try that.
They'll revert back, at some point to an old style, then go, oh crud, that's why that, instructor told me to do that. This bit me right in the ankle here. And I didn't see it coming. And that happens, because I do that myself. I'll do something and circumvent what I kind of know is best practice or better practice. And then, I'm chasing down a bug and I go, oh, for crying out loud. You know, you're a knucklehead. Just, you forgot to do the obvious. But he goes on to say that, he understands at a certain level, he talks about from the instructor's perspective, grading assignments that are varying, very widely varied in solutions would take forever.
It would.
So it's
How do you weight that grade?
You either have to, it's a difficult thing but like he says, take it with a grain of salt. He's not saying it's a bad thing. He's just saying that weigh it in, and that person may be an advanced novice, in the Dreyfus model.
Right.
So, he may, and the instructor is fine and probably an advanced novice because they teach a little bit better, because they're closer to the novice level.
Right, exactly.
Than the expert would. So it's a really interesting short read, and then it gives you links to the Dreyfus model and to the single entry, single exit theory. So it's a good short read, and you can pick up some tips. And it also led me to look into this this book called The Programmer's
Programmer's Thingy.
Programmer's Thinking Thingy. Mm. No, it's wait, what is it? Ah, crud. Well, anyway, it's at the bottom. And
okay.
The Angry Monkey is part of what book? So, that book.
I don't think I read the Productive Programmer.
Oh, okay, I think it was out in 2008, but it still seems to have some legs on it because they're basic concepts. So there's some good stuff there, too. If you haven't seen The Productive Programmer, actually, O'Reilly has a video series on that as well as the book.
I'm just putting in the developer feed now.
Yeah. You might want to look at that Productive Programmer.
Productive Programmer, that's the one. Yeah. All right, cool. So that's another interesting one. Yeah. It's an interesting topic because software, you know, grading a piece of software, it's like grading a piece of art. You can, you know, I'm stretching a little here, but you know, you can implement the same solution to a problem, many different solutions solving the same problem. So you get almost an infinite variety if it's a complex enough question of ways to solve it that maybe most of the class isn't ready to grasp, you know, sure. For example. So, yep, cool. All right.
We could debate this all day because I'm thinking of all these different things. Like, test state, but then you could hard code, and that would be invalid, right? So, we can talk about that another time.
All right, so let's see. Let's talk about Heroku a little bit. We got two articles on that. First one is Getting Started with Java on Heroku. Now, this is James Ward, right? He's now working for them. And he put together what is this thing here?
I went to the link that's there on the dev news page, and it's pretty interesting. It comes up with a simple page with a list of radio buttons, and you can choose your approach that you want to use or your technologies that you want to use, whether it's Java, Spring, Java, or you want to deploy on Jetty or Tomcat or Scala, Akka, Clojure. There's different options, and if you look at the radio buttons to the right, you can just jump to the Git repository for the source code, pull that down, and then open it up in your favorite IDE and start playing around with it and build an app for Heroku. But you can also, I guess, add yourself to the developer list for that project. I don't know.
Yeah, it looks
I didn't
like,
click on that link yet.
What, the step two here?
The step two where you just you choose the technologies and then you put in your email.
Look at this. I did the one Java app with God knows what. It cloned the app, gave it to you in your GitHub account as a clone of the app.
Oh, okay.
And then set it up in Heroku. So nice. All you do is you then download it. You know, you do a Git, I guess, a checkout. And then you just go ahead and do your work. Push to Heroku master and change something, and you're good. So basically for all these things, it's like having almost like a Maven prototype. Archetype.
Okay.
That then pushes live to Heroku. They do it for you. They do the infrastructure. They set up and hand it right back to you.
Nice.
Running. That is cool.
That's cool. I'll have to do that because I did download the Spring MVC app, which is actually Spring Roo 1.2.0 app, and pulled it down. And then I immediately went in and made changes to it. So I'm like, wait a minute, I should just go back now and do that.
Yeah. So, can you just Git push Heroku master?
Yeah, because one of the I blogged about this a few months ago. I blogged about pushing Spring Roo because I spoke at Java 1 on rapid application development in Java for the cloud. And I used Heroku, CloudBees, and Cloud Foundry as my deployment targets. And so that's something I blogged about a while ago. And I was curious to see how it differed now because it's been a few months. So I haven't gone through all of it yet to find the details.
But that's very cool.
Yeah, that's cool.
So I'll link to that in the show notes. It's looks like javaheroku.app.com, java.herokuapp.com. But that's something that James Ward has blogged about and then point to.
And also Grails.
Grails.
So yeah, as we round out our topics here, yeah, it fits in there.
Yes. Actually, I don't see the Grails one on there.
It's down the middle somewhere, right?
Oh, yeah, Grails 2 demo. There we go. Very cool. Yeah.
And Play is in there, too. I've not played around with Play, but apparently we're going to have someone speak about that at ETE, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I may have to check into that presentation because I don't know anything about Play.
By the way, unfortunately, if you wanted to go to ETE, by the time you listen to this, we're sold out.
Yeah, we sold out as of yesterday. We had a planning meeting around noon. We had 40 tickets. And then I came in this morning and got the emails that we were done. It was sold out.
So guess who's doing the Play Talk?
James Ward?
James Ward.
Sweet. All right. Well,
he's coming to see us.
Now we know. And then I can apologize to him for anything I might have misspoke.
Oh, that's okay. So, yeah, he's actually doing HTML5 apps in Java with Scala and the Play framework.
Oh, nice.
Play has a bunch of Scala bindings or Scala version of the API, or I don't know, it works well in that. So if you're interested in Play, for example, or if you're interested in Scala and you're going to ETE, great. If not, we're working this year with a videographer who's a good friend of ours, did our video for the Chariot website. And I think we have a pretty good plan for recording a lot of the sessions. I don't want to say all yet, because God knows what technical difficulties you run into.
We have, five rooms running five in parallel, rooms. So that might be challenging. I don't know. I don't know that's details you're more in touch
with. Yeah, we're trying. We might actually get there. Cool. It's really just timing. So hopefully coming out of that, we're going to have some good video this year, and hopefully in a lot quicker time frame than we did last year. We all did it as volunteering our time last year until we got it going, so it took a lot of effort. And we only did one room. Anyway, enough of that. Okay. So yeah, I just did the Java and Heroku with the Roo app, I guess, and it's out there. So, all right, let's move on to another topic with Heroku. This one's really interesting. They have in Heroku with a hosting app, right? They've got different databases, but their default, I think, is either SQLite or Postgres, depending on what system you clone. I think Postgres is the one you normally get.
Yeah, so, I forget off the top of my head, but it might be MySQL and Postgres, but I forget.
MySQL have to actually add, but yes, do it. Yeah, they have like a couple different versions. So, but Postgres is like the one that they do lightweight by default. So, for example, our website, that kind of thing. So apparently, they've got a feature in their Postgres service that just lets you clip a URL called a data clip. Let's see. So, you know, some people, when they're showing data, they'll do things like they'll use a gist file and clip that and paste it to an email and say, take a look at these query results in the SQL. That's a lot of steps. But if you just want to quickly say, here's a query and look at the results for it, you can go to a page. There's like a service for this for every database that you install if it's Postgres. And the service is a SQL console with results.
Wait, so a SQL console meaning you can just...
Like you can bookmark a query in a SQL console in Heroku, and you can do what they call a data clip of it, right? So I clicked on the one from the sample article that they have in the Postgres blog, and it goes to like postgres.heroku.com, and then I guess data clips, which I'm guessing is like a URL kind of like gist is for GitHub. It's a web service URL. Okay. And then you get this data clip. Once you mark these, it's probably the data clip command in Heroku, and it generates the query itself in a query pane, and then the results snapshot it as of when you ran them. And you can also click now and have it do that, and have it actually load the data as it currently stands. So you can actually take a look at some, you know, as a developer, you're saying, you know what, this particular query is blowing up, take a look at this, or this query has problems with the data. You can actually clip them right to the live data or to the data as of a snapshot.
And the devil's advocate side, what are the protections for that? I mean, is there
unless you make it public,
right?
You would have to log in. I'm pretty sure you can protect these. In fact, if you couldn't protect them, then never use this feature. Right.
No, of course. That makes total sense. But it's just one of those things. If I were listening, the knee jerk reaction would be warning. SQL on the web,
danger.
SQL injection. That's evil.
Yeah.
You know, what's the risks and what are the, and I'm sure that's been thought out. I mean, Heroku folks are pretty reliable source. So
it's interesting though. So it's called Data Clips. Let's see here. Just trying to see. Okay. Anyway, I'm not going to try to read this while we're going to bore the hell out of everybody.
Yeah. If you're,
hey, listen, hold on.
If your data's getting too long, do you go to Data Clips? Oh, that's great.
Yes,
clips.
That's like quick clips. Yeah, right. Yeah. I would like the number 2 for my data clip. Okay. So.
Yes, that was a value add.
Yes, joke. Value drop.
With air quotes.
I want to take another minute on the Chariot side of life here. We should sing that in Monty Python style. And point out a few things that are going on in our social media space. Right now, we've been doing a lot with the screencasts. If you go to screencasts.chariotsolutions.com, these are all free, and you go and look at what we're dishing out there. We've been putting out screencasts from ETE 2011, but then we started doing a few new things. For example, we're starting to do some on things like Maven. I'm doing a series on that, just basic introductions to Maven. That's the first one, and then one on dependency management. We put our last, believe it or not, we put our last published performance from ETE. It's DSLs. Does expressive lists for domain experts have to compromise the underlying implementation? By Debashis Ghosh. That came out in January. So if you haven't been there in a while, there's that. There's a talk on MongoDB on the 4th of January, and on 7 programming languages on the 8th of December. So we have a bunch of them up there,
and those actually. Those are from last year's ETE?
Those are from last year's ETE.
So yeah. They run about, what, 30, 40 minutes?
40 minutes or so, yeah.
Okay.
They're about
okay.
as long as a session, and sometimes we edit it down if there's lots of question and answer.
Okay. Sure. Now, I'm just curious to give a summary of what you're looking for.
Yep,
sure.
And they should play on most modern browsers, H.264 video. Our podcast, as you listen to this one, they've been cooking along. We're going to be interviewing. We just interviewed Alex Hillman, who's doing one of the talks at ETE. But we've been doing dev news pretty steadily. I have a couple more interviews coming up, so that's rolling along. And our blog has really been cooking lately. We have a number of our people blog, and we're starting to put some of those blog posts on our main blog, which is blog.chariotsolutions.com. And so I'm looking here. Today we have an update. There are two of our mobile people are doing blog posts about Sensu Touch, which is a JavaScript touch platform, and then also on jQuery mobile. And so those are rolling along. Gordon, you had a few things recently around Spring, like the constructor namespace.
And two different blogs directly on the Chariot site for Spring 3.1. I have two or three more that I have to do. I'm prepping for a revision to next week's enterprise integration course, but mm-hmm. I'm going to get a couple of more out at least by the end of the month. And I also blogged on my site, which Chariot has a link to, on how to install RabbitMQ mm-hmm. on a Mac system on OS X Lion. So because there's if you go out to the site, you can do some simple installs for RabbitMQ, but in configuring it, it's not as cut and dried. So I have a lot of tips and some file examples there. So you can get started quickly.
Right, great. So again, that's blog.chariotsolutions.com, and along the right, you'll see the links. If you click on some of these, they'll point right to the blogger themselves, depending on where we post them. All right. Okay, getting back. We have a few more things, and we'll wrap it up. Let's see. Specializing generalist. So someone here, his name is Tyner Blaine. And Tyner Blaine has a talk or a blog article here about specializing generalists and about agile teams. So let's say you're putting together the dream team for your agile project. You get whatever is greenfield project or a really critical project, and they say, you know what? We're going to trust the agile process here. So quick releases, you know, everyone is somewhat of a generalist. That's what you try to do, is you try not to have too many deep specialists in one area in agile. But what he's saying is that there are some people that think that generalist means that everyone has to know everything about how to do everything. And you'll spend forever trying to find those people. Right. So
not only that, but it's very difficult to have somebody that has that broad brush.
Yeah.
Knowledge base that's deep enough, because there's yes. only so much time.
Exactly.
In anybody's work day, even if you work, you know, were so much of an enthusiast, you went home and read everything, there's only so much you can actually practically do. So it's years under your belt to be able to have that.
Right. So there's I'll just kind of paraphrase from this. I think there's Elena Yatsik was who was reading a comment from her about specializing generalists. And then he read the article, and he went back and he said, she said, I'm not sure I agree in practice that you can or should try to staff all teams with specializing generalists, or at least not as taken to an extreme. And then he went back to the maturity model article, which is where this is all based on, from Agile Maturity, he said that the people over process is the right emphasis. He said, if you can't find people that are good enough, you might as well go home. Well, no kidding, right?
Right.
Doesn't matter how agile you are if you don't have the horsepower, et cetera. Keep going. You're also better off with specializing generalists. Ideally, every member of the team can do any work that is needed. His point was really that you want people that do have depth, but that are willing to share it and are willing to pair with people and impart that knowledge or even help them to increase their skills in that area. And everyone should have that ability on the team is the point.
Yeah, and that's an essential part of a successful team, and I'm a big advocate of that. I don't like to hold too much close to the vest. I like to share information because it makes everyone work better, and it makes me feel good that I get to share stuff that I'm excited about, or you know, and that's usually that's my motivator anyway. But yeah. You know, it really helps everyone, and to hold stuff close to the vest is a bit paranoid, and it has a short lifespan.
We've both been on projects where people, you know, someone gets to that position and they're holding everything closely, and you know, you wait for their design to show up, and half the time you look at it and you go, I don't know what the hell you're doing.
Right.
And then, and I don't think you do either, but you're doing really fast. Yeah.
And it, you know, it's one of those teach me to fish, not feed me. And you know, they think they can just feed everyone, you know,
and then reduce the fish.
And then the team can survive or thrive, and they can't. You just can't grow that way. And the team, you know, that person becomes too centric, and you know, it's not a good philosophy overall.
So here's a, I mean, I'm just reading this part now, but T-shaped people. Sounds a little weird, doesn't it? From an HR perspective, I was taught about T-shaped people. People who have breadth and depth of skills. So specialists are I-shaped. If you think about like a vertical depth.
Oh, okay, right? Sure. Yep.
So you've got like that really deep only in one area, your DBA, your, you know, only one framework expert, only one language expert, that kind of thing, or whatever. Generalists are minus-shaped people, right? So you've got a lot of breadth and no depth.
Right.
But a T-shaped person is someone's going to have a depth of expertise in one area and a breadth across a bunch of others. And that's what HR people also try to look for in corporations when they're looking for that good team member overall.
Sure. And that's what, you know, that's a, like, I know with my Spring experience that I have, it's that you need to have that skill. So you're basically vertical in Java and Spring, and you're horizontal across the other 20 plus open source projects. You don't need to
know
everything
well. No.
Yeah, in great depth. But you know enough of those things to know where to look, you know, how they tie together, so you can be useful, you can be capable and functional. But your single expertise is, or your, you know, those are narrower.
And it seems like, you know, just in working this field for so long, it's great when you run into someone who's had more than one of those T's, right? So like you and I, for example, you had expertise in all sorts of stuff before you came to where we first started working. You know, we both had expertise in Power Builder years ago, and you know, I had Sybase expertise, and then we moved on to the next thing. It was pretty much WebLogic and Java and Struts and things like, you know, and now we're moving on to the multi-languages and things like that. And, you know, Spring certainly having a big role for us, but also like multi-language support and, you know, things like, you know, different web platforms. And so I'm digging into Rails a little more.
Right.
And you know now, after you've done a couple of those dives, it's easier to do the dive. It doesn't frustrate you. It doesn't scare you to jump into something you're completely foreign to. And you know you're going to be stressed, right?
Right.
You know you're going to be driven nuts by it for a while. And you'll look at the gun. I know I'll sit there. I just don't get it. And suddenly the light switches on. And you're like, oh, that's all it is. And then it just becomes another one of your, you know, little dives through the ice.
Yeah, I think that's more of a confidence thing, right? Because once you've done that a few times, you realize the light bulb's coming. You know, frustration is the gateway to knowledge.
You're right.
So you get frustrated.
I've heard you say it before. You're absolutely right.
You get frustrated with something. Eventually, your brain will find the solution, and that'll click, and you're like, oh. You know, and sometimes you're like, how can I be such a knucklehead?
Yeah.
And other times you're like, that's amazing. You know, and there's certain things I look at, and I'm like, I don't know what the excitement is about yet. But then when I dig in, I go, there it is.
Now I get it.
And that's a cool thing. So, yeah, it's exciting. Yeah.
Right. Cool. That was a fun one. Let's see here. And for fun, I was, before this started, I was thinking to myself, you know, if you had the wrong team, and I've been on the wrong team before where they had, like, here's your database expert. Now, I've done this. When I was early on in my management-ish career and tech lead career, I put together a team that had a strong web, what I thought was a strong web developer, a strong infrastructure and back-end developer. I was kind of like a glue person doing the translating the business requirements, being the tech lead and taking a piece of the functionality, and a business analyst. We made it, but what we found was that the one person in our team who didn't know what they were doing, we didn't know he didn't know what he was doing until the very end of the first phase. And we had to gut all of his code and bring someone else in to rip it out and replace it.
Wow.
Because we weren't deep enough in the more complex areas, and we didn't have our hands in everything, so we didn't find out. And, you know, Agile just knocks that out and says, you know what? You code review each other's code constantly. You pair program with people. You work with each other. You don't own code. You... you share the ownership with everybody else, and everyone jumps in to help everybody else. And that never would have happened, you know?
Yeah.
And you find times when you have idleness, like people are waiting on the data dude to get the data model going, so they can't do much because there's work that has to be done in the initial stab to figure out just what we're building.
Right.
So with everyone's a generalist, everyone can jump in where needed, you know?
Yeah, and that's, I mean, it's definitely a good approach. I think it's a hard paradigm shift for some corporate developers who, you know, they're afraid to look at other code or touch it because we live in a or work in a who touched it last mentality. So
yeah, many
whoever touched
are.
That file last owns it.
Yes.
So, you know, the person who prior to that goes, I didn't touch it. I didn't check it in. Somebody else did. And then they want a hands off. So it's
right.
If you can get everybody some, I guess, thought process moving in that direction where everybody owns the code, you
right.
know, and sure, the last person who checked it in may have caused an exception, should have written the proper unit test and so on.
Right. So then I had a little fun with it. And I said, you know what? What if you had a team like the International Justice League of Super Acquaintances?
Nice.
Do you remember this? From SpongeBob?
Yeah, I probably have seen it because I'm a big SpongeBob fan, but I don't remember the title.
So there's the character Mermaid Man and Barnacle Boy, right?
My favorites, yes.
Yeah, they're great. So at one point they broke up and one went to the evil side. With I first Man Ray.
I must have missed this one.
Oh my God,
it's
great.
I have to check it. Yeah.
So here's, and if anyone has kids, you're going to start laughing because you probably have seen this. But here are the members of.
You'll have kids. Go get some.
Yeah. League of Super Acquaintances. First one is Mermaid Man, and his power is the ability to throw water balls. Remember, you know, yeah. in your pool, you like go right. spin it and you shove your water ball, and about the same thing happens to him. It fizzles out on the way in. SpongeBob becomes the Quickster. He's uncanny ability to run really quick. That's where the lines like, want to see me jump over those mountains? Right. Want to see me again? And so what does he do? He knocks over Magma and destroys all sorts of stuff and because he's too quick. And then Captain Magma is who Squidward is, and he's got a volcano in his head, so he sets things on fire and screws that up. And then the elastic waistband is Patrick and his tentacles can go anywhere or his body parts. And then Miss Appear, who goes invisible and then she trips over things and no one can see where she is and they trip over her. So, yes. So anyway, I'll have to put a link in there.
But that's your vertical.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's your vertical.
That's your vertical team.
Yeah.
Everyone's got a skill and they're going to screw each other up completely. Yeah.
So. Well, you know, this is a time proven, you know, concept of, you know, what about the proverbial bus?
Yeah.
If so-and-so gets hit by the proverbial bus.
Now what?
Now we're going to be stuck. We're going to sit in the water until we find a suitable candidate who can just magically supplant that, you know, person. I mean, because people move on. They go to a different project. They go to a different company. They decide to,
moved.
You know, yeah, right.
Yeah.
Dig a hole for a living, be a shepherd, whatever they decide to do, you know. Often thought of breeding sheep and herding sheep.
Yes.
So, you know, if that's your life passion and you move on, then, you know, the other team at least can muddle along instead of being dead in the water.
True. All right. Well, that wraps up the content portion and pretty much almost all of our podcast today. If you want to learn about what Chariot does, we are a consulting, mentoring, and training firm. You know, we do a lot of consulting in open source space platforms, such as Rails and Spring and Hibernate and all sorts of stuff like that, business applications. We also are working in the mobile space, doing apps for iPad, iPhone, Android, BlackBerry. And our training focuses mostly on the enterprise Java space right now. We do have a couple of courses I wanted to highlight. One of them, which is coming up, is the, let's see, we've got Core Spring. By the time we hear this one, the enterprise integration with Spring, there's just enough time to register if you just got this before, let's say, the week of the 21st.
There's, as of this recording, there'll be one next week, so clearly you won't be able to get to that. But, look at our calendar.
Yep, it goes all the way out to June.
Yeah. It's my favorite Spring course in that, you know, I'm more integration focused. I'm more in middleware focused. So I enjoy teaching the class. I enjoy the content of the class. So definitely check into it if you're doing anything that you're talking to from one system to another.
It's all in there.
And from, you know, and concurrency and those types of things. it's definitely something to look into.
Yep. And more near term, we've got Core Spring classes running every month. Right. We've got a Maven, two Maven courses coming up, which I believe I'll have the most up-to-date versions of those courses soon. But Maven on March 15th is a one-day intro class, Maven Mechanics, and then there's a infrastructure design one where we get into continuous integration with Maven, which is very cool.
Is that a new course or is that the 201
course? That's the 201 course.
Okay.
Yeah, that's always been called Development Infrastructure Design. So, that one gets into, you know, installing Hudson in their example for continuous integration. It gets into using Nexus for the version control, which there's a new release of Nexus just out yesterday, Nexus 2.0. But Nexus is part of it. Talking about how you do releases, how you cut them, how you move things over, and more complex configuration stuff. So that's a really powerful one. That's on March 16th for a day. Relatively low cost, very, very worth it. And then later in the month of March is Hibernate with Spring. That's a three-day course, a little cheaper than your typical Spring course because it's a one less day. Has a little bit of a refresher on the Spring platform, but it's a two-plus-day intensive dig into Hibernate and JPA. We talk all about the JPA 2.0 annotations, where we jump down to Hibernate annotations where needed, and we also get into a little bit on the JPA API as well as the Hibernate API. And we talk about all sorts of things from locking to session management to version control of rows and, you know, good entity design, relationship design, things like that. So it's a really, really good course. And again, that's on March 20th.
And I should have out by that point or before that point, a blog, and I have the code of my GitHub repository, but how to configure Spring Data JPA with Hibernate. You don't need to use a persistence XML with Spring 3.1. So that's another Spring 3.1 feature that I'll be
coming up
blogging about.
Sure. All right. So if you want that blog article, it'll be at blog.chariotsolutions.com. Our training is at chariotsolutions.com/education. And, of course, at the main website, you find all the other good stuff that we do. Okay, so that's it. So for Dev News number 43, I'm Ken Rempel.
And Gordon Dickens.
And you have a good week.